Bien, merci de vous asseoir. Nous allons commencer le séminaire et je suis très heureux d'accueillir aujourd'hui le professeur Alessandro Lenci de l'Université de Pise. I will switch to English because you will be speaking in English. And so welcome to Collège de France. We are very happy to have you here. Professor Lenci was trained as a linguist initially and now he's the head of a computational linguistics lab. So he's really at the border between these two disciplines trying to capture algorithms that correspond to how we interpret words and how we interpret sentences. And the key concept here is distributional semantics, or we might call it vector semantics, the ability to represent the meanings of words in a formalized mathematical computational manner, and to see how these concepts can be combined to generate semantics at the sentence level. It's a very, very exciting possibility, which I think is being open. You are all aware that computers have made huge progress in processing language. So we are really looking forward to hearing about the latest theory developments as well. And I close by mentioning that Professor Lenci just published a book called, Distribution.
No, he's going to publish.
It's very hot in the press, literally, and at Cambridge University Press on distributional semantics. Thank you very much for being here.
Okay. Thanks to Professor Dehaene for inviting me here. I'm very honored to give this talk to you. Actually, my story is even more complicated in the sense I was originally trained as a philosopher of language, and then I moved to linguistics and then to computational linguistics. So it's a long way home, but still, I mean, there are a lot of family resemblances between these fields. So basically, the first part of this talk, I will give you some hints about what is distributional semantics, which is very active field nowadays in semantics, especially in computational linguistics and artificial intelligence, although perhaps less known by and less used by traditional linguists. Also because it uses a different way to represent meaning. And then I will especially focus on the use of distributional semantics to model some aspects concerning the way we understand sentences. So going beyond the domain of words to the domain of sentences, a complex linguistic expressions. So I think I might need to switch off. Okay. So. First of all, let's start from the basics. So concepts are collections of features that are derived from our experience. So if we think about our concept of a cherry, we can see that, well, it's usually formed by a lot of features derived by our sensory, motor, and affective experience of cherries, tasting cherries, liking cherries, hating cherries, and whatever. And this is, of course, related to our exposures to objects and events. And this is basically, these aspects of our conceptual representation is crucial in, mainstream models of cognition, so-called embodied cognition approaches. But on the other hand, we don't have to forget that we are also exposed to lots of linguistic experiences. So we are exposed to lots of linguistic inputs from which also we derive information about cherries. And so we derive information and features about cherries by reading, by listening, by being exposed to language in general. And basically, nowadays, after some wars that took place some years ago, let's say that the main trend is to imagine that these types, both types of this information, so-called embodied information, so the ones that we derive from first-hand experience and the linguistic information, are both related in our conceptual representations. So the idea is that we should aim for some kind of so-called representational pluralism, in the sense that concepts contains many types of information derived by different sources, exactly because our experience are of very different types. But there are, of course, also domains of our concepts, so areas of our semantic memory, that are perhaps for which linguistic information is also perhaps more relevant and more dominant. So, for instance, we can think about abstract terms. in which, of course, we don't have perhaps a direct experience about a reference or an object. But also, we don't have to forget that we don't have experience of many concrete objects we talk about. So we probably read about aardvarks, so we read and we listen about the cyclotrons, but we never experience one. So we have a lot of linguistic information about these entities without having really been directly acquainted to them. And there is also lots of literature that, for instance, children use a lot of so-called distributional information. So use the context in which words occur in order to converge or to identify at least in some aspects of their meaning. So if we have, if we take a verb like gorp in this sentence, the Mary gorp married the book, we can anyway identify the fact that it's probably something related to give. And in this case, gorp might be more related to say or to believe or to state and whatever. So linguistic experience is relevant for many conceptual representations. Now, this is concerning the content of concepts. So we can assume that concepts contains both linguistics information and other type of, let's say, embodied experiential, other type of experiential information. So what about the form of concepts? So, okay, we assume that concepts and our conceptual representation are this amount of different type of information, but how do we represent them? Well, traditionally in linguistics, but also not only linguistics, also in cognitive science, concepts and conceptual structures are represented with symbols. Symbols which can be list of features like this, by saying that, well, we could say that a dog is something that is animate, it's not an artifact, it has features which could call bark, it has another feature that which you could call, it has four legs, and so on. Can be some structure like this, like saying that, for instance, a verb like enter represents an event of something going into certain place, or can even something more complex, and I don't go into details of this. Okay. The only thing that imports for us is the fact that these are symbols. These are just formal structures that we use to represent aspects of the meaning of these linguistic expressions. And we can also choose a different representation. Imagine that our semantic memory is represented as a network of these symbols related by different types of relations that link these elements. Okay, independently of the specific formalism that you may use, what all these things have in common? Well, for instance, the fact that they are qualitative representational concepts. You can see there are no numbers in that. Okay, there are just qualitative symbols, okay? And in the symbols, you can either match or you don't match, like letters in the alphabet. There are discrete in the sense that, well, dog has this feature or does not have this feature, okay? There is nothing in between them, okay? And of course, and this also has problems in the sense that we know for large experimental data that concepts are not rigid. Concepts have fuzzy boundaries, are continuous structures. There are a lot of in-between things, a lot of gradients in concepts that, of course, this type of models and representations can hardly tackle. There is another problem concerning this type of representation. How do we choose our symbols? And the problem is that we usually choose them a priori. So we decide that, for instance, plus animate or plus bark is a feature in our model. And so the problem is that, okay, how do we identify the repertoire of these symbols that we use for our semantic representation? This is usually the duty of the linguist I'm really trying to destroy this. I'm sorry about that. I have this kind of Italian waving way of using hands. This is part of my cultural endowment, so you have to forgive me about that. Another problem is the fact that, in fact, this rigidity, this of these structures, make them quite make hard to explain a lot of semantic phenomena. Okay, and the risk is that we have to make our semantic machinery much, much more complicated, exactly because we need to address complex phenomena that originally these symbols are not geared to. Another important aspect is that these symbols are amodal. Amodal means that they are formal structure. Okay, so how do we integrate, for instance, in these symbols information coming from perception or from other type of modalities? And last but not least, usually these models don't come with sound models to learn such a representation. So the problem is that how do we acquire this type of information from experiential data? And this is one of the reasons why, especially in this symbolic model representing meaning, the aspect concerning semantic acquisition are, so to speak, sometimes left out of the picture, in the sense that, it's hard to model it, to explain this process with this type of representation. Well, in cognitive science and in artificial intelligence, there is, anyway, another different way to look at concepts. And the idea is that concepts are not symbols. Concepts are mathematical structures, and essentially are mathematical structures called vectors. We can simply see as a row of numbers. And these numbers here stands from features that are extracted from our different inputs. So the idea is the fact that we experience inputs. For instance, we experience a cherry, and we extract some features from that, and we turn into numerical numbers. And this is not very different from what our brain does, in which we experience the features, these features, the cherry, these cherries brings or produce some input into our retina, which is then into translate into signals to our neurons that activate some areas in the brain. Okay, so we can imagine that also the neural activation in the brain is just a series of numbers that you can represent at a certain abstract level as a vector. Okay. So this is a very different type of representing concepts and a very different type of representing meaning, of course. What is the main features of this type of representation? Well, first of all, it's continuous and distributed. Distributed means that basically all the informations bring by these entities distributed between the different numbers. It is the ensemble of these numbers that bring in some kind of representation, for instance, the representation of a dog versus the representation of a cherry. And of course, it's continuous because it has numbers in it. So we basically don't have a discrete representation, but a continuous representation. And so this makes this representation more apt to tackle exactly phenomena concerning gradients and fuzziness and whatever. On the other hand, another problem is that this type of representation are exactly less stipulative, in the sense that basically we don't usually choose a priori the type of dimension, but we let imagine that these dimensions in the vectors are learned or acquired from the data without deciding a priori which type of dimensions should be relevant. And this allow, and we will see in our cases, to have also methods to learn such representations from the data. And this brings a semantic acquisition back into the game, so to speak. Okay. Importantly, in vector codes, these features are not necessarily a modal. As you can see here, these features could encode both features coming from language, but also features coming, for instance, from our perceiving SRA. So this means that actually this type of representation allow a better integration of different type of information coming from different sources. As for now, there is nothing specific concerning distributional semantics. This is a usual standard way of representing concepts in artificial intelligence and cognitive science in the age of connectionism back in the 80s, more or less. Of course, we will see these representations have, in a way, some problems, in the sense that they have still some limitative explicative power of semantic facts. So we still have to find a way to explain different type of semantic phenomena with this type of representation. And we have to keep well in mind this fact. So basically, what is distributional semantics? Well, distributional semantics is a way to put these two things together. Use vectors to represent the fact that linguistic information is also important in order to shape our conceptual representation. Okay? So basically, it brings together these two aspects, the importance of language as a source of information for our concepts, and a specific way to represent concepts with vectors. Basically, distributional semantics is just the study or a research area that focuses on how the statistical distribution of lexical items in linguistic contexts can be used to model our semantic knowledge. So basically, it answers to specific questions. How the fact that we observe, that we use language in a certain way, affects our semantic representation. Okay? How the fact that a certain word is used in certain context with other words, while not in others, affects the way we represent the meaning of these words. What is the way in which distributional semantics tackle the semantic representation? Well, basically, as I told you, distributional representation of a lexical item, of a word, is just a vector. But this vector encodes distributional data. So encode co-occurrences of these words with other contexts. So how many times, or some more complex mathematical function or mathematical operation of this, how many times a word has been observed together with other words? And at the basis of the distributional semantics is what is so-called the distributional hypothesis. Namely, the idea is that the words, lexemes with similar distributional properties have similar meanings. So basically, if two words tend to occur in the same linguistic context, they will tend to be very close in meaning. So if we flip the pancake, and we can say, OK, I can take a word, two words, and I can record how many times they've occurred in context, and if these words tend to co-occur basically in similar contexts, I can infer that these two words are similar in meanings or almost synonymous in meanings. Well, as I told you, distributional semantics is quite hype nowadays, very popular in computational linguistics, but it's not at all a new thing. The first mention I found of distributional semantics go back to 1962 by Paul Garvin, in which he says that actually, you see, distributional semantics is predicated on the assumption that the linguistic units with certain semantic similarity also share certain similarities in the relevant environments, in the relevant context. So basically, the idea is the fact that if two words are similar, have similar meanings, they will tend to co-occur in the same similar context, and therefore, if we have computers strong enough and power enough to collect lots of these contexts, we can also understand if two words are close in meaning or not. The pioneers of distributional semantics are actually not computational linguists. So we can find a linguist like Zelig Harris, the supervisor and the mentor of Noam Chomsky, one of the fathers of structural linguists, in which exactly assumed or claimed that the way to understand the meaning of two words is exactly by looking at the context in which they appear. And another, father of this type of way of conceiving meaning is John Firth, who you might know for a very famous expression, you shall know a word by the company it keeps, namely, you know a word, the meaning of the words, by looking at the words with which it goes with which it co-occurs. And again, this is nothing else that something that which is normally and routinely used in distributional semantics. But we also found another important thing, at least for me, and I think for us now in this audience, is the fact that distributional semantics is not only being, practicing in linguistics and computational linguistics, but also always in psychology. And for instance, George Miller talks about the notion of contextual representation. So his idea is the fact that when we hear a word used in language, we keep and update a representation of the context in which these words is occurred. Okay, and basically the idea is knowing the meaning of a word means to know the context in which these words can actually be used. So concretely, what distributional semantics does? So basically, the idea is this: let's start from some linguistic context. So let's start from words that occur in certain contexts that we can find in a corpus, we can find in whatever text. And we can collect all the words that are, for instance, close by to a certain target words. So we can, for instance, fix the window of two words to the left and two words to the side. And we can look at which words appear within these words. And we can find that, for instance, car stands close to drive, car, cat stands close to eat, van again stands close to drive, and so on. And let's imagine that we don't collect only these small amounts of content, but we look for huge corpora and we harvest tons and tons of this type of information. Well, the nice thing is the fact that now we can represent this type of information with vectors. In the sense we can use vectors simply to compact all this type of distributional information. And now these vectors, what represent? These vectors basically represent how many times a certain word has occurred with a certain context. For instance, we can imagine that like a Cartesian space, whose dimensions are, for instance, linguistic context or words, and whose points in this space are also words. And basically, what determines the position of a word in this space? Well, it's simply the type of context in which these words has occurred with. So for instance, the number we see, we represent the word with the vectors, with a series of numbers. And these numbers record how many times this word has been close to drive, eat, and run. And for instance, in this case, we can see that the dog has a closer amount of numbers shares many contexts with cat, but dog shares much less contexts with van. And if we represent this geometrically, this means that in a space, dog and cat will appear close in a space and farther away from van and car. And interestingly, is the fact that we can measure this distance. Okay, so we can measure how two vectors are close one to the other or are far away one to the other. There are different ways to measure this. One is the so-called cosine, which simply tells us, well, two words are closer if the angles of their vectors are small. So basically, the idea is the fact that if each word represents a vector in this space, the smaller this angle here, the closer two words are. And this is just nothing else than a formula that allows us to measure this similarity. Okay? And at the end of the story, what we have, we have a way in which we can calculate the distributional similarity. So how close are the distributional environments of these two words? And these numbers here simply tells how close are two words. For instance, these are cosines, and a cosine is a number between 0 and 1. 1 means that the word is just similar to itself. And the higher the number, the more similar are the two words. So in this case, for instance, dog is quite similar to cat, but is, for instance, less similar to car, because these two numbers are just smaller. Okay, this is nothing else than a quantitative way to represent the similarity or as proximity and the dissimilarity as distance in a space. Okay? So this is the advantage of representing words and concepts in as vectors, that we can measure the distance between these vectors in the space. And with distributional semantics, one important aspect is these vectors are learned from text, are learned from language, and record how many times these words co-occur with different linguistic contexts. Now, in the distributional semantics, there are many ways to build these vectors, many models, many methods, and these are called usually distributional semantic models. Distributional semantic models are nothing else than a way to say, okay, we have a method in order to learn, to acquire this vector-based representation from corpora. And of course, these methods differ for many type of parameters, for many type of aspects. For instance, for a long time, for many years, this so-called latent semantic analysis has been the favorite method, especially in psychology. Nowadays, one very popular method is this one here that uses neural networks in order to learn representation. But the important thing is simply that there are different methods to learn representational words with vectors, encoding their distribution in linguistic context. As I told you, this is just a kind of classification of different models that are used nowadays. For those that are more in the field, the most popular models are so-called neural embeddings. Neural embeddings is just nothing else than a way to learn vectors using neural networks. There is an important aspect that I want you to, I want to point out, and it is the distinction between so-called explicit vectors and implicit distributional vectors, in the sense that there are two types of distributional vectors that can be learned. In the simplest case, the vector dimensions encode a specific context in which the words have been observed. So we can assume that, for instance, the first dimension of the word of a vector corresponds to the verb bite, the second to the context by, and so on and so forth. This means that actually we can take a vector representing bike and interpret specifically the dimensions, the context in which it has occurred, because there is a one-to-one correspondence between the dimensions and the specific context. On the other hand, another type of vectors, and these are the ones so-called embeddings in the neural networks literature, represent vectors with a very small numbers of dimensions. Usually, when we take a realistic vectors of this side, this has thousands and perhaps hundreds of thousands of dimensions. Okay, and most of these dimensions are zero. And the reason why are zero is because words have a Zipfian distribution, and words are choosy, so to speak, in the sense that tend to co-occur only with a small amount of context. And this makes this matrix full of zero. Neural networks and other methods use a compact representation of these vectors, which is obtained by carrying out what is called dimensionality reduction. Dimensionality reduction is just a way to extract some information from the original data, getting rid of noise and exploiting redundancies in the data, with a drawback, unfortunately, that what you obtain is the vector whose dimensions are not interpretable any longer, in the sense that there is no, or it's very hard to interpret the specific dimension. Look, here you can say that, for instance, the second dimension corresponds to the verb to buy, but here, well, this is just a kind of more abstract information extracted from the data, but we are not able to assign any specific label to these dimensions. In these cases, with this type of vectors, the interpretation comes from the relations between the vectors in the semantic space. Okay, I don't go into much details about that, but that's the basic difference. Now, an important thing, I told you that the distributional hypothesis is typically couched in terms of similarity. In the sense, we usually claim that two words that are distributionally similar are semantically similar. But it's important to understand that the outcome, the product of these distributional models, is not so much similarity, but relatedness, which is very different, which is a related but different issue. Let's consider this example. These are target words, and these are neighbors. Neighbors are words that are close in space to the targets. Okay? So this means that the cosine between this word and this target here is very high. Okay? You can imagine it's a kind of neighbors within the semantic space of dots. Okay, you can see here that in many cases, the closest neighbors to the target are not at all semantically similar. Okay, so for instance, heat is not semantically similar to hungry. It's related to hungry, because when you heat, it's because you're hungry. Okay, and for instance, car is, can be similar to truck and vehicle, but car is not similar to driving. Driving is an action that you perform with the car, so it's related with the car. This is an important distinction, okay? Similar means that you share a lot of features. They have similar shape, similar functions, similar categories. Related means that, as I told you, hungry and heat and food are all related one to the other, belong to the same situations, but are not semantically similar. So this means that actually this type of models are more prone to identify networks of related or more semantically related entities. And this is a problem, in the sense this means that the outcome of these models is a very coarse representation of meaning under many respects, which we don't have to forget. Anyway, independently of the coarseness, and as I told you, these models are very extensively used in artificial intelligence and in computational linguistics, but they have been shown to be able to model lots of cognitive phenomena. So there are lots of work in cognitive science and in psychology showing that the data that are derived by distributional models are able to model the way we represent concepts and the way concepts are organized in semantic memory. Okay? And this concerns, and this even concerns fMRI activations. So it has been shown that representing words with this distributional vector allow us to model the activation areas of specific contexts in the human brain using magnetic resonance. Okay? So this means that these type of models are useful for cognitive research and to model behavioral data. And if we want to be to dare a little bit more, this can be an indirect proof that indeed parts of our semantic representation is distributional, in the sense that at least part of the information that make up our concepts is in the form of distributional information derived from linguistic usage, as we were saying, we're seeing at the beginning. Okay, just to make a very quick recap. So basically, distributional semantics offer both a model to represent meanings with vectors and a way to learn these vectors from language data, but not only, because we can also learn this type of vectors using, for instance, from images and putting these two things together. Remember, distributional representations are continuous because they're vector, gradable because, they can be measured their closeness in this space. It's not discrete, it's gradable representation. Distributional semantics rely on what we could call a contextual or usage-based model of meaning. What I mean by this, in the sense that meaning is shaped by language usage. Okay, remember the word by Firth, remember the word by Harris, but this is also quite popular, for instance, in cognitive linguistics or in construction grammar, in other type of approaches to language. The output of a distributional model, we said it's a measure of semantic similarity, or more loosely, a measure of semantic relatedness. And important thing, distributional semantics is primarily a model of the lexicon. As you can see, until now, we have only talked about words. Okay? It's good, and most of the research that have been also, that has been explored in which distributional semantics has been applied in cognitive science concerns words, single words. But this is not enough, because language is not only single words. Language and modeling language, understanding semantic representation, it means to go beyond the domain of words. Okay. Let's make a small experiment. Let's start with a small, with a cloud of words. Forget about syntax. Just take these four words. I imagine that although these are just words randomly placed in the space, you can form a coherent representation by gluing these things together. If you focus on that, you can just a specific event pop up into your mind. And these specific events is something that you can express with a specific sentence, okay? But you can see, you don't even need that sentence. You just look at these words, you imagine that they form something coherent. These words magically are able to glue together and to enter into a coherent representation. And this is something that is a, this ability is also part of the fact that this is a very common event. You probably experienced, you did this event yourself, or you experienced this event in many situations. And this is probably also the reason why if we give to Google this type of four words without any syntax, also Google is able to recover lots of this information that describe a specific event that we were expressing or representing with that sentence. Now, take these words. These words are related one to the other. Right? They can allow, we can assume that they bring to belong to the same domain, book, book parts, book actions, and whatever. But I think, at least for me, it's quite hard to combine them, to make a specific event and to glue them together in this way, although they are all semantically related. They all belong to the same domain, so to speak. And now let's take these words. These words are very different one to the other. They belong to very different domains, very different areas. We probably never experienced them together, but I believe that you also are able to build again a coherent event or a coherent sentence out of them. And, well, this could be something like that. A surfer reads a papyrus in a forest. It's a strange event, but we are able to generate this event simply by looking at this at these entities. Why? Well, because a surfer may be a reader, like a student. Papyrus, well, that's not the typical things that I read, but it's a kind of book, or it can be a kind of book. It can be read as well. And, well, a forest, it's not a very typical thing where you can read, but it's a location, so like a library. So, again, you are able to glue these things together, so, although they are pretty new situation. And in these cases, we are much better than Google, because you can see if we give these four words to Google, we are not able to find any relevant image, exactly because it's a brand new event that we are not stored anyway, but we are able to construct on the fly, so to speak, or online while comprehending this sentence. Okay, what does this example show us? Well, this example shows a very specific but crucial aspect, that the fact that the brain is able to combine concepts to form coherent semantic representation of situations and events, what we could call a kind of semantic binding, or semantic gluing. Another interesting thing is that, of course, syntactic structure is a powerful tool to allow us this combinatorial combination. If I say to you, a surfer reads a book in a library, the fact that you recognize a surfer as a subject, a library as a location, help us to identify these things. But we can see that it's a powerful tool, but it's not even always necessary. In the sense that, provided that we have enough background knowledge, we are also able to combine these things together. And there are some work by Binder and others, and on the more theoretical side by Jackendoff, that, again, raise these issues on how much syntax and how much our ability to build semantic representation is independent or parallel to the combinatorial tool provided by syntax. Altogether means, what does it mean? This means that the concepts have a combinatorial structure that allow them to be bound together to form a coherent representation. And this combinatorial structure is something which is surely linked to syntax, it's helped to syntax, so syntax is a kind of powerful tool in order to carry out this type of gluing, providing lots of cues with morphology, with order, and whatever. But we can do also something without them. In some extreme cases, we can do this. Okay, we can have extreme cases in which we can even do concept combination without having much syntactic structure. Now, the problem is that how we model in semantic representation this concept gluing. Okay, here is where symbolic representations have the so-called the winning position. In the sense that in the symbolic tradition, it's easy to model this kind of conceptual gluing, exactly adopting the notion of function and argument. In the sense, assuming that there are concepts that have variables, that have slots, okay, and other concepts that are able to fill these slots and to bind these variables in order to build a complex representation. Okay? So, for instance, and what is the outcome of this semantic representation? Well, it can be an event. Or if you want to be more sophisticated, somebody talks about it as a truth value, because it means that you are able to judge whether something is true or false. Did the surfer really read a book on a papyrus on a forest or not? Is it true or false? Okay. But the idea is exactly this. So we'll have something like read that has some slots in it, and perhaps there are types that allow us to constrain which type of element can fill this slot. So, for instance, the reader must be necessarily animate. Okay? And there are elements that are able to fill these slots, building a coherent representation of this. So this type of gluing is very easy to be performed in symbolic representation. It's not at all easy to do it with vectors. And exactly one problem is exactly this, how we can glue vectors together. And that's the topic of long-standing research in artificial intelligence and computational linguistics, which is exactly the, how can we glue together concepts in order to provide the semantic representation of sentences, of phrases, or even discourse. Well, there is a lot of complicated, complex machinery, mathematical machinery in this, but I will not go into details about that. Basically, the general idea is this. Since we have vectors that represent words, we use operations between vectors to represent the glue that allow us to put these two things together. And there are many operations from linear algebra that allow us to to make this glue between concepts. For instance, we could simply add the vectors. So basically, the idea that the representation of the surfer reads the papyrus in a forest is simply a vector obtained by summing the vectors of a single word. Okay? Or we can make some more complex things like so-called tensor product or circular convolution. There are just terms for very complex operations that we can use. Some researchers have also tried to say, okay, let's use the function argument metaphor from symbolic representation and do this. Like there are function and arguments, there are also things, mathematical objects that behave like functions, and others that behave like arguments. And they have used something like tensor by vector multiplications to perform this operation. What is the problem of all this research, in a way? It's a huge field, which I cannot, of course, summarize, but I mean, just to give you a hint. Well, compositionality, cannot, of course, model by simply summing the vectors of the words cannot be the whole story. We know that. Because, of course, what it will mean? Well, it will mean that if the meaning of the sentence, a cat chases a mouse, is just the sum of the vectors of its word, this means that the meaning of a cat chases a mouse should be exactly the same as a mouse chases a cat, because sum is commutative, and so summing a cat plus chases is just exactly the same as summing chases like cat. So it cannot be the whole story. Okay, that's, we all know that. But strangely enough, this is still the best performing way to build this type of representation. So when tested, all complex models happen to perform or worse or not significantly better than simple vector addition. And so there is something strange in it, something that really doesn't satisfy us. But there is also general intuitions about that. Okay, on the one hand, we have a kind of solid intuition about what is a distribution representation of a world. We have said, what is a distribution representation of a world? It just encodes the other words that words at concourse with. So the fact that the cat concourse more with dogs or eat rather than wheel and car. Okay? And the vector just encodes that. But it's not clear at all what is the distributional representation of a sentence. What does it mean? Okay, what is the distributional representation of a sentence like catches mouse? Okay, we don't have clear intuitions about that. It's much clearer for us to imagine that the representation of a sentence is an event or a set representation of a situation. And in which sense a vector is able to represent an event or a situation rather than a single entity. Imagine that an event is not a single entity, it's a cluster of objects. Okay, the surfer, the book, the papyrus, the forest, all glued together. Okay, in order to present you a different view on these things, let me just make some different assumptions that, and some bringing you some evidence from, cognitive science. So basically, the idea is the fact that comprehending a sentence is an incremental process that allow us to build a coherent semantic representation of event. This means that it's the same process that we did when we were gluing together these words in the cloud experiment as before. And another important aspect is usually sentences are partial description of events. This means that we left out lots of details. Okay, we don't tell any details about situation. Okay, and several details are left implicit and can be recovered from the context. So, for instance, if I say something like John surfed yesterday, I can infer the fact that John probably used the board, that John was in the ocean or in the sea, but not on the lake, that John wore a swimsuit or a wetsuit and whatever. All these things are not mentioned in a sentence, but are part of the things that we understand when we understand the meaning of that sentence. Okay? And this brings in the fact that lots of understanding involves our ability to predict. So understanding a sentence allows us to make predictions. Predictions about the things that have not been stated, predictions about things that will be followed up in the rest of the discourse. And this aspect has been stressed in many ways in cognitive science. So for instance, in this work by Moshe Bar, he points out this idea that the brain is actually a proactive and predictive engine. So the fact that the brain is constantly engaged in making predictions. Prediction about and prediction help us in order to process the inputs, in order to anticipate the things that will come. And what our predictions rest on? Predictions rest are memory-based. Of course, we can predict things that are based on the memories of our past experiences. And what is the glue between our past experiences and what we predict is similarity, or why we call it analogy, but use analogy in the sense that I use the term similarity. So basically, I have lots of memories of past experience, and I use and I predict that similar things will happen in the world. And Andy Clark has also stressed this idea of the crucial role of prediction in the brain. And an important fact, and in fact, there is a crucial difference, cognitive difference, between these two sentences here. A student reads a book in a library, and a surfer reads a papyrus in the forest. In the sense that it's true that we have a potentially endless capacity to build a sentence representation of a novel sentence like this. So we are able to build a semantic representation of a new thing like this. But crucially, the sentences react in a different way, the brain reacts in a different way when this new sentence is presented with respect to an old sentence. So basically, we process these novel sentences have a different cognitive status from old sentences. And this different status is notoriously registered, for instance, with the event-related potentials, and for instance, by the different amount of the so-called N400 component, which is higher for things that are novel, less expected, less predicted, or less predictable with respect to things that are new, that are known, that are well predictable from the context. So what does it mean, this? Well, it means that what we can assume, that it means that on the one hand, productivity, so the ability to understand novel sentences, surely entails that not everything can be stored in our memory. And that's a classical argument for compositionality. The brain is able to construct new things by gluing things together. On the other hand, data suggests that there is also a lot of stored knowledge about concept contingencies, concept combinations that are stored in our memories, that are used by processing. And this means that, and this knowledge is activated by linguistic items during this processing and affects language processing. And usually combinations that are more distant from the things that we have stored in memories cost more from the cognitive point of view with respect to things that are known or are simply retrieved from the memory. The idea is the fact that which type of knowledge is stored? Well, we have lots of knowledge about single entities, but we have also lots of knowledge about associations between the entities. Okay, and the relations between entities. And this is what, for instance, Ken McRae and others called generalized knowledge. So knowledge about typical events and typical participants. Okay, and knowledge about the typical events is simply the fact that, and this type of knowledge, again, derives from different sources. Derived from direct experience, for instance, because we go to restaurants or we go to libraries, but also from linguistic experience. Because we read about restaurants, we read about libraries, and we read about what happens in this type of situations. And basically, the idea in this model is the fact that the linguistic expressions are simply cues that activate different aspects of this knowledge that we have stored. And this knowledge is combined during sentence process in order to allow the understanding of new situations. Now, this type of stored knowledge is something that he also used in order to, as an effect, for instance, during the during online sentence processing, in the sense that we are able to automatically understand whether a certain argument is more typical for a predicate than others. So this is what is called the thematic fit. Thematic fit is the ability of an argument to fit, to complain with the expectations of a certain predicate. So for instance, arrest the tree is impossible. But both arrest the thief and arrest the policeman are possible. But arrest the thief is much more prototypical than arrest the policeman. Okay?
And we are, and subjects have clear ideas about what is possible, what is impossible, and what is typical and atypical in this context. And interestingly, this type of information can be well modeled with distributional semantics. And distributional semantics is used, they can be used exactly to model these judgments. And the idea is similar. Why thief is a typical person who is arrested? Because thief is very similar to the entities that are typically arrested. So basically, what we do in distributional semantics, we can simply say, okay, let's take some arguments of a verb. For instance, argument of a verb eat, apple, meat, pasta, and pizza, and we represent all these things as vectors. And by combining the vectors, for instance, by simply making the sum or an average, we can make a new vectors, which is the kind of vectors that represent, let's say, the typical things that are eaten. Okay? And then we can simply compare a new object as a vector with these vectors. And by measuring these similarities, we can understand which things are eaten, which things are eatable, which things are things that are prototypically eaten, like, for instance, a cake, or things that are less prototypically eaten from a human, for instance, I don't know, an ant. Okay? Okay. All this information, all this type of data have been put together by us in a model we are developing in collaboration also with Philip Blush at Aix-Marseille University, which is exactly the idea of using all these different data coming from cognitive representations to propose a different way to use distributional representation, distributional semantics, to model sentence comprehension. Basically, our idea and our model is the following. We have what we call the memory component and the unification component. A memory component, and this is inspired to a model called Memory Unification and Control Model by Peter Agort. Basically, what memory component does? The memory component stores generalized event knowledge, so knowledge about events event and situation, that we model with distributional information extracted from corpora. So we use distributional information not only to model single words, but also to model the associations that these words have in forming events and situations. The idea is that during sentence processing, lexical items, but actually in our view also constructions in general, like multi-word expressions and whatever, activate portions of these representations that are unified to form a coherent semantic representation of the event expressed by the sentence. And interestingly, each compositional operation is associated to what we call the semantic composition cost. A semantic composition cost is basically answer this question: how expensive is to build this semantic representation? Because we have seen that not all sentences are equal. Some tenses are easily more processable than others. So what is the cost of this semantic representation? And according to us, this composition cost depends on two factors. The fact that some structures are available in our memories and can be simply retrieved because they are there, they're stored, okay? And on the other hand, the cost of making a semantic representation coherent. The idea is the fact is that the more coherent is a semantic representation, so the more the pieces of the semantic representation are things that are go well together, the easier it is to process this type of structure. That's the idea. That's the idea of our network. So basically, what we do is we build, we consider, we represent this with. 5 minutes and I will close. We'll skip some things, but just to give you the hints. The idea is the fact that we have a network of interrelated items and events and participants which are stored. And the interesting thing is that each of these elements is a vector, is a distributional vector. But these vectors are linked one to the other by relations that bind them together into a network of events and situations and co-occurrences. Okay? So basically, it's a kind of hybrid representation. You see, the idea is that these concepts, these vectors, are already glued, but already glued in our memories, are already glued in our typical associations that we found in the general knowledge. For instance, in these cases, we can see that a student reads a book, writes a thesis, and so on. What is an event? An event is just a path in this network. For instance, the event of a student reading a book, or a student or a professor reading a thesis, or an archaeologist reading a papyrus, and so on. And the idea is the fact that lexical items activate this type of representation during sentence processing in a kind of similar vein to the standard spreading activation. And for instance, a student activate a portion of the graph with respect to the different type of events which involves a student, but also read activate different type of portions of these elements. But the point is that this is not enough because we have to bring this thing together. Okay? And the idea is the fact that during sentence processing, we model semantic composition exactly as a process of event retrieval and construction. So basically, semantic composition is a is a process that aims at recovering events that are stored in our memories, or to construct new events from pieces stored in our memory. Given a sentence, what is the interpretation of this sentence is just the event that best explains its linguistic cues. That's the idea. And of course, there can be two situations. An event can be simply something stored and available in our memory, or can be something that is constructed by linking together portions of this information. And so, for instance, if I read something, a student reads a book, we simply retrieve the event of this stored in our memory. But if I process something like a surfer reads a papyrus, what we do is we build a new event by linking together things that are not stored in a memory. And as I told you, the idea is that we choose the event that the best explains. What does it mean to best explain? Best explains according to two parameters. The degree of activation, which means that the event we choose the event that is activated the most cues in the linguistic item. By the linguistic items in the sentence, which we measure with a score which we call sigma. And on the other hand, the internal semantic coherence of new events stored in memory component. So basically, it is the joint effect of these two elements that explains this idea that the sentence processing is a balance between storage and computation. On the one retrieving, on the one composing and gluing things together. What does it mean, the mutual typicality? Mutual typicality means certain things are typical actors in a certain event. So for instance, a surfer is similar enough to typical readers, but for instance, is not similar enough to typical papyrus readers. So this makes a sentence like a surfer reads a papyrus acceptable, but not so prototypical or so easily processable than a student reads a reads a book. And this semantic typicality is measured with thematic fit cosine. So basically, we use the vectors in this semantic representation in order to estimate how similar are the things how coherent is a semantic representation. Okay, just to going back, okay, we have applied these models to model different type of cognitive data. coming from the psycholinguistic literature. I don't have the time to go into details because I want to spend the few minutes to the conclusions. And these are the conclusions that I want to draw. Namely, first of all, conclusion about distribution representation. Language shapes our semantic representation. This is something which is almost nowadays agree on. Of course, the interesting question is how much it is, how big is this effect? Okay. So for instance, what is the neat contribution of language vis-a-vis other type of empirical data? For instance, sensory or sensory experience. We have seen that distributional semantics is not a panacea. Okay, it's not the new wonderful way to represent meaning. It offers a lot of, it has actually a coarse-grained style of representation. It cannot distinguish between similarity and relatedness. In many cases, the representations are very, very coarse. And we can see that still, having a simple theory, how we build the meaning of a sentence or even a discourse is complex, and probably we don't yet have a very convincing story about that, okay? On the other hand, the fact that we work with a continuous and distributed representation allow us to give us a lot of advantages. Tackling greatness, context dependencies, the ability to learn representation from data, and last but not least, providing bridges with neurocognitive models, because we are, in a way, talking about the same language, talking about the same way of representing meaning. Distributional semantics and sentence process. As I told you, distributional information is not only relevant to build the vectors, but is also, useful in order to model the network of associations that link different type of words that are part of our everyday knowledge that we use during the sentence processing, and which is so crucial for us. And this is reminds me, and I was this is a kind of suggestion I want to bring to you, of a recent paper by Jeffrey Binder, in which exactly makes a similar idea. In the same, on the one hand, we have neural activation of objects, perhaps at a very low level of sensory motor features, for instance, the features representing a dog or the feature representing this table. But then we need to have more abstract representations that link, for instance, a dog with a leash, with the action of walk, with park, or that link this dog or this table with the room, with the lectures, and so on. Okay. And this type of representation, this type of associations are of a more abstract level, what he calls cross-modal conjunctive representation, so a more abstract level of representing things. And this is not very different from this idea. So on the one hand, we have vectors of single entities, but also we have representations of their associations that link them together. Distribution information is retrieved and combined during language comprehension. And this is a powerful tool for us because we can make predictions and generate expectancies. For instance, from our knowledge about students reading books, we can expect that they read it in the library. Okay. And this allow us to make some inferences and to fill in details. And I would like also to say that this idea, in a way, try to redesign the boundary between what is stored and what is processed, also what is idiomatic and what is compositional. So in the classical story, idiomatic expressions, things like key the bucket, are of course stored in our lexicon, while things like kick a ball are simply composed online with rules. But the idea is probably that we actually are able to retrieve a lot of things that are simply compositional, and we retrieve them without constructing online, simply because they are very frequent and simply because they are things that are usually exposed to. But how is the ability and where the ability to understand the novel sentences come from? Well, the idea is the fact that we retrieve and we combine information stored in our distribution representation. And the important thing is the fact that the salience and the importance of a new event, an event that we have never encountered before, like the surfer reading a papyrus, it depends on how similar is to things that are expected or similar to things that are stored in our representation. And this similarity can be measured thanks to distributional semantics and to vector representations. We have seen that the vector representations are good to measure this, and we can do it also in this way. So basically, my last word is this, that language productivity, so the ability to produce new sentences, to understand new sentences, to combine concepts, can be conceived also to the capacity to adapt our knowledge to novel situations. So basically, productivity is a kind of adaptation, and adaptation can be driven by similarity. And I stop here, and these are my collaborators on this project, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So this is working, we can open it for discussion. Maybe I can start by asking a question myself. So I was wondering, I think this approach applies quite well, as you say, to individual words, but in particular to open class words.
Yes.
And I was wondering whether you could extend it to closed class words, grammatical words. And take a very simple example, negation, for instance. So I tell you, my car is not green. How do you process such a structure in the framework that you showed for sentences?
Okay, the problems of function words is a big problem for distributional semantics in general, in the sense that, for instance, there is not a real interesting story for negations like that, okay? So there are some treatment of some pragmatic negations like, my car is not green, it's yellow, okay? Or my table is not brown, it's red, and so on. But simply stating the negations like John didn't read a book yesterday, it's really hard. There is not really an interesting story for that. My personal position is the fact, actually, that we probably don't need to have an interesting story for that in distributional semantics, in the sense that we need to have a vector representation for these elements, but we probably don't have a way to learn this type of representations from corpus data, from these things. So my personal position is that we could perfectly live with a kind of even more formal representations of certain structures with, let's say, distributional representations as part of some components with that.
I think okay. I would agree with that, actually. I think we need a logical
Absolutely.
Language
That's
of thought.
Exactly. And actually, this idea of representing events is in a way incompatible with that. Mm. So my idea is the fact that an event like walk is not a single, it's not only a single vector. A vector like walk is a whole network of relations between things, locations, so on. It have probably also formal relations between them. We could call them thematic roles, and we could,
We are back to a whole array of logical
Absolutely.
Apparatus on top
so
of
So these links that I show you here, for instance, I remain quite agnostic about what are these. Okay, for me, are labeled with, for instance, semantic roles, at least in some cases. So, for instance, we can have something like that the student is not only linked to read, but is linked by a certain relation we could call agent or subject or whatever. The problem is that in other cases, these relations are not clear at all. So, of course, there is a close association between student and professor. Okay, but probably we don't have even a name for that, and we don't even have a symbolic name. So the important thing is that we have different labels or different types of association between them. And this brings to the idea of having a kind of symbolic structure from that. Okay, so the whole idea of this model is to combine vector representation within a structure which is not itself a vector, but it has a more formal a formal representation.
So maybe we should open it to questions from the audience. Are there some questions?